Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Welcome to California. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Don, how you doing? You ready to start exploring beautiful California?
I'm ready to hang 10, dude.
Yeah. Oh, man. See, the problem with people doing the surf guy voices now is they just sound like Ninja Turtles.
Yes, that's true. Cowabunga.
Okay, so this is, of course, the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums and the album format. We find all kinds of silly ways to talk about them and hopefully delight our audience with some great recommendations. So we've got a great show for you this week. We're continuing on our Bands Across America summertime road trip. We're hitting California, focusing on Southern California this week. So we'll each bring an album from an artist or band from that area. Don's going to ask us the deepest of questions. We'll also have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items we're digging, new releases, etc. And then we'll get into what we'll be exploring on next week's episode. But this week, welcome to Southern California.
Road trip! That's what I'm talking about!
Southern California, renowned for its sun-drenched beaches, vibrant history, and iconic sites like the Hollywood Sign and Santa Monica Pier, this region stands out as a hub of creativity and culture. Southern California's musical legacy is woven into the very fabric of its cities, home to legendary recording studios and innovative sounds that have influenced everything from surf rock to hip-hop. Whether you're visiting world-class attractions or simply enjoying the laid-back coastal vibe, Southern California welcomes you with a spirit that is both live and unforgettable.
I'm sold. Yeah, so there's an enormous list of artists. I mean, my first inclination was the Sunset Strip, like, you know, 80s hair metal bands, like doing a Poison record or Rat or something like that. Didn't go that direction. But also, of course, the Beach Boys, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg. I mean, all of NWA, you know. No Doubt is from the area. Billie Eilish, Rage Against the Machine. I mean, we could go on. Those are just a handful of top of mind artists and bands.
But the Doors.
Oh, of course, the Doors. I mean, that I wanted to do that too, but we've done a lot of Doors on the show. All right. When we get moving here, we've got the albums queued up. The tank is full and Southern California is ahead of us. Let's roll out with our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
Our first stop on our journey through Southern California takes us to Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young with the album Deja Vu, released in March 1970. So it's actually the second studio album for Crosby, Stills, and Nash, but it's the first one that included Neil Young. So Crosby, Stills, and Nash was kind of a folk rock supergroup. David Crosby from L.A. Was in the Byrds. Stephen Stills from Texas was in Buffalo Springfield. Graham Nash was from England, actually, and was in the group The Hollies. And Neil Young was from Toronto, Canada, and also a member of Buffalo Springfield.
Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Beautiful. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Crosby, Stills,
apparently,
Nash,
you know, after the success of the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album, you know, they felt like Stephen Stills was carrying most of the instrumental load. Crosby and Nash were, you know, more just vocalists in the group. So they wanted to have a fourth member, mostly for live performances. And, you know, they sought out Neil Young. Originally, they wanted Steve Winwood, I guess.
Oh, I had also heard that John Sebastian was...
Oh, that would make sense.
In consideration.
Yeah.
Yeah, from the Love and Spoonful.
But Neil Young, you know, wasn't satisfied with just being a touring member, so he negotiated his way into being a full member.
Get that Y on the CSN.
Yes. Yeah. It does look better with the Y.
Yeah. Well, it looks almost like a word. Ksnee.
All right. Well, let's check out the album. Here's the first track, Carry On.
Love is coming. Love is coming to us all.
Man, those guys suck. Those harmonies are so pitchy.
So yeah, that's another song that's kind of hard to choose a clip from because there's really like, you know, three distinct parts of the song. But that's kind of the a cappella bridge. The song is written by Stephen Stills. Apparently, Graham Nash had said that they didn't really have a good opener for the album. You know, they wanted to start big. So Stills had an unfinished song called Questions, which was from the Buffalo Springfield era. And he combined that with a jam session, I guess they did a few days before. You know, the Questions part kind of deals with uncertainty, you know, I think sort of bigger existential questions, but maybe also, you know, questions about a relationship, themes of resilience and perseverance, you know, strong opener, I think.
Would the kids call that a mashup of Carry On and Questions? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's themes of unity in there too, but the dual guitars, the vocal layering, those groove shifts, it's kind of like prog folk.
Yeah.
You know? Yes. This is definitely the first little sprinklings of ingredients for that Laurel Canyon sound. You know, I think they helped define the baseline of what that Laurel Canyon 70s soft rock harmonies, like bands like America and stuff that came along that, you know, like Horse With No Name is by America. So yeah, this song certainly sets the tone. And I grew up on this record. My dad had it when I was a kid and played it an awful lot, so it resonates with me, nostalgia as well, you know.
And I mean, you really have the unique harmonies of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. There's something about they're a bit dissonant, I think. I don't think they're traditional chords, you know, like what the Carter family would have done or something like that. So, but that style, I think, of harmony ended up being adopted by other artists. Yeah, let's keep moving along with the record. Here's the next cut, Teach Your Children.
Teach your children well. Father's hell did slowly go by.
Song just makes me feel a certain way. I don't know.
What is that? What's a certain way?
Sort of.
We're, okay, this is very important. This is a podcast, Don. And vagaries don't work for the audience.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's kind of a nostalgic feel or something, or kind of a warm feeling. It's just so, you know, pleasant sounding, particularly with the pedal steel guitar, which is actually Jerry Garcia from the Grateful Dead.
So he's influencing the children to maybe become deadheads someday. Yeah.
Apparently, it seems like some sort of deal or negotiation, because this is right before the Dead did Working Men's Dead and American Beauty. Mm-hmm. And Crosby, Stills, and Nash promised to help the Grateful Dead with their harmonies. And if you listen to those two Dead records, you definitely hear that influence.
Nice.
Anyway, Teach Your Children was written by Graham Nash in 1968 with members of the Hollies, but they never put it out. I've never heard that version of it, but apparently it was kind of silly, sort of in that Henry VIII kind of style. I am Henry the Eighth, I am.
Henry the Eighth, I am. Teach your children well, my friend. Yeah.
Apparently, it was Stephen Stills who got him to kind of transform it into a country and folk song.
Yeah, some of the lines in it are just amazing. You know, teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, you know. So maybe, you know, the experiences of your parents, listen to them, you know, they should use those experiences to bring up their children and help them not have to deal with the things that they did. But then the juxtaposition of teach your parents well, the children's hell will slowly go by. I always just loved this even as a kid, because it felt like it was an adult song about me, you know, about my people, about kids and families and being there for each other. It's nice.
Did you ever say to your parents, hey, I'm teaching you?
That would have been welcomed compared to the actual things I said.
All right. Well, let's keep moving. Was there a particular song you wanted to talk about?
I felt like we needed to focus on the young a little bit, not the children. So here's a little bit from Helpless.
Birds flying across the sky.
I remember when I was a kid being like, Big Bird's flying across the sky, but that's not Philippagus. I was like, Big Bird doesn't fly. That's a Sesame Street reference for the uninitiated. So, this one was written by Neil Young. Very simple descending chord progression. This is one I can actually play on guitar. It's D-A-G. Serene, deceptively straightforward. It evokes deep nostalgia. I guess it was inspired by Young's childhood in rural Ontario. I mean, he mentions Ontario at some point.
That's good.
Thank you. I guess it's more about a feeling than like precise coordinates on a map. CSN, it's like their vocals are floating like smoke around Neil Young's aching vocal. I mean, the guy sounds like he's in pain when he does that particular register of his singing voice. And I don't think he's straining.
That's how he sounds. Yep.
The inner pain coming out. Yeah, it's kind of like a spiritual cousin to his Harvest era.
Yes.
To Neil Young's solo career. What are your thoughts on Helpless, Helpless?
Yeah, well, this is, I think, the first time on the record where it's obvious that Neil Young is there.
Yeah.
In fact, I think several songs on the album, Neil Young isn't even on the track. I don't think he's on Teach Your Children or Our House.
I remember looking at the liner notes on the vinyl of this when I was a kid and looking for their names, and I do remember his being missing on a lot of songs.
Yeah, but this one is, this is clearly a Neil Young song, but I do think the Crosby, Stills, and Nash backing vocals really just make it something special. So, yeah, I really like this track a lot, and it does very much fit into that After the Gold Rush and Harvest period in his solo career.
Sometimes I complain about it when there's disjointedness. The threads that make this an album are these guys' voices and songwriting chops. They fit because they sound great.
Yes. Yeah. And I do think the eclectic nature of the album actually strengthens it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's check out the closing cut. Here's Everybody, I Love You.
Everybody, I love you.
I love Stills' soulful kind of Joe Cockery kind of voice, that he's able to throw in. That's when he's at his best. Like, he has his own tracks and featured moments, but when you can pick him out in those songs because of the uniqueness of what he brings vocally, I love that. Even on a song that I don't think is the best.
Yeah. It's just amazing how talented all four of these guys are. I definitely recommend, if you've never listened to a Stephen Stills album or a Graham Nash album, they're excellent. So Everybody I Love You is co-written by Stills and Young. So it kind of goes back to their Buffalo Springfield days. It kind of reminds me of Ohio, which I think comes on the next CSNY album. Kind of has that sort of rockin' edge to it, but still has the CSN vocals. The lyrics, deal with themes of universal affection and encouragement and self-acceptance.
Brotherhood.
Yeah, there's a lot of that on this album, but
well, it's kind of what these guys are.
Yeah.
A musical brotherhood.
But it's not trite for some reason. It's not corny.
Well, it was the time, man. There's just so much joy in the fact that they're making this music.
Yeah.
You can feel it. Like, it's not phoned in. It's not for label reasons. It's just creative freedom. And but I like this song. I feel like it's not the best closer, though. I would have preferred the song Our House as the closer because it's so sweet.
Yeah.
And, so this is kind of this journey of these guys growing up to some extent. So then closing it with the family and another family life type of song.
I know what you mean.
Yeah. That's just me.
Yeah. It seems like Neil Young kind of likes to end with like a guitar track.
Rocker.
Yeah. And, I really get the sense that Stills and Young really were, kind of letting loose on this one or kind of dueling with their guitars on this.
In general, I think there's more guitar, bluesy guitar parts and solos than people think of when they think of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young or Crosby, Stills, Nash. They think it's just this folksy acoustic stuff, but there's a lot of, 60s, 70s style rock guitar on this too.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, let's take a moment to rewind and reflect on Deja Vu. I'll start with my clickbait headline. CSNY, teach your boomers and helpless friends to carry on into the 70s. Yeah, that was lame, just trying to throw a bunch of song titles in there. But, you know, it does feel like, you know, it is that transitional period from, you know, the hippie, you know, Woodstock period into the 70s where we're, mm-hmm. you know, it seems like people are moving from San Francisco to LA and hanging out in Laurel Canyon stuff. But also, you know, kind of a darker, maybe more cynical time in the 70s. But yeah, I mean, the overall vibe of this album, I think the star of the album is the CSN vocals. Yeah, I mean, their vocals are just unique and powerful and, you know, just add a softness, you know, to music that is sometimes challenging. But as you said, you know, there's also, you know, some grit in there. And I think it probably has a lot to do with Neil Young that you get that raunchier sound in there with the guitar. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a fantastic overall vibe. How about you, dude?
I guess we can start off with my clickbait headline to describe Deja Vu. Wow. Feels like someone said something like that before. Just experienced it myself. Four icons, 800 studio hours, and a folk rock masterpiece.
800 hours, damn.
Now, that's what I read. Yeah. That it was. That there was a lot. I mean, you got four solo artists, essentially, all with their own ideas.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of tape that is on the floor there.
Yeah, I picture like all four of these guys were probably like the bullies in their groups.
Yeah, they were the bossy ones and then they're all together. Yeah, so like my overall vibe, love it.
Love it.
Yeah, so it's really, you know, it's these artists operating within the shell of a group, which I think is just more of a think tank, a musical think tank, you know? But yeah, it's acoustic serenity meeting psychedelic edge. It's not really a flow album like I talked about. Each track stands on its own, but the sequence kind of tells this larger story, all about their personal growth and their lives. And it you know sounds like a family reunion.
Yeah, we always like to mention the killer to filler ratio. I think it's mostly killer.
I agree.
Even cuts like Almost Cut My Hair, you know, which seems kind of corny. That's a David Crosby pen tune. But I think because of the time, you know, the idea of your hair being this sort of method for protest is.
Yeah, it meant that you weren't a grown up man. You were counterculture. You know, you're supposed to get a shave and a haircut and go get a job, you know?
Yeah. Of course, Woodstock is a cover of the Joni Mitchell song. Although it's weird to call it a cover because they were basically released in the same year as hers.
Well, yeah, and wasn't Nash and weren't Nash and Joni Mitchell a couple?
Yes.
So kind of it's like, okay, we'll both do our versions.
Yeah. And Nash, who also penned Our House, that was sort of inspired by, I guess, a domestic, you know, sort of experience with Joni Mitchell. But I guess there's songs that maybe don't stand out so much, but I don't really.
Like 4+20,
yeah,
maybe.
But even that.
Neil Young's Country Girl. It's a three-part suite. It's very ambitious. I don't know. I guess it fits the least if one were to nitpick.
Yeah, maybe.
But it's still a great song.
Yeah, I agree. And the production, I think it's great. I mean, it's hard to imagine this album produced in a different way. Somehow you get all the instruments, you know, so you can hear every little part, you know, quite well. And they did this without like a boss producer.
Right.
You know, they mainly did this themselves. So that, I mean, that's impressive that they, you know, ended up with a pretty cohesive sonic experience.
Yeah. I guess similar to what we talked about in North Carolina with James Taylor, it's like analog warmth. Mm-hmm. Like it's organic, but not lo-fi, lush, but never overdone. And the personalities and nuance comes out. So that's good production from my perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, I've listened to this hundreds of times in my life and I'll continue to do so. Replay, like, is this an album that you can just pick up regularly?
Yes. Okay, well. I think, you know, I mean, because each time you listen, you could, you know, focus on the harmonies and, you know, the unique chords that they're creating. You could focus on the instrumentation, the guitar.
Right.
And, you know, as far as the legacy of this album, I mean, it's obviously huge. It also is kind of a time capsule of that Woodstock period, you know, that 1969, 1970 period.
Even looking at the album cover, it's got like a the vinyl version anyway, had this textured photo album type of feel. And then the picture of the guys in black and white looks like a old timey family photo. Like, I think it's hinting at the photo album-esque, you know, moments in the album where these songs are all pictures of different things like you would see in a family photo album.
Yeah. I mean, when somebody says California sound, I tend to think of Beach Boys, Jan and Dean kind
of
stuff.
I think of '80s heavy metal. Oh, that's right.
So you kind of have this sort of this California sound as well. Mm-hmm. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's Deja Vu is both a time capsule and a living document. It's cohesive, filled with standouts. It's lovingly produced and deeply influential both within and beyond its California roots. Check it out.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. So, like we've done with all the wonderful areas we've been visiting on this summer road trip, let's explore some of the other cultural treasures from this area. So what other cool things came from SoCal, as we like to call it?
Hollywood. Yes. I mean, the obvious thing is just Hollywood and movies and all that stuff. But skateboarding, mm-hmm. The Z-Boys of Dogtown. You ever watch the movie Dogtown?
I don't think so.
It's about the origins of that, one of those first big like kind of skateboarding teams. But
I remember Gleaming the Cube.
Yeah, I remember that too. Yeah, Christian Slater. But yeah, like just skateboarding. Boarding culture, the music, I think that sort of pop punk stuff feels like it came hand in hand with that as skateboarding developed. And of course, Tony Hawk, but you know, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. I remember playing that game on PlayStation. Mm-hmm. And that's the closest I ever came to successfully doing any skateboard tricks. I was terrible at it when I tried. How about you, Donny Boy?
Well, I'm going to go right to the food this time.
Me want food! Yes.
Glenn Bell opened the first Taco Bell. I had no idea that there was a Bell in the name.
Really?
Yeah, it's weird.
Oh, okay. Good thing his last name wasn't Toilet.
Nice.
Because it makes you poop.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So in Downey, California, which is apparently in Los Angeles County, he opened the first Taco Bell with 19-cent tacos.
Wow.
Particularly when you're young and you're – you know, scrounging change together, you know, at the food court. Yep. Taco Bell was the cheapest option.
Well, and your body's indestructible.
Yeah, that's true.
You can eat 12 of those things and suffer no consequences.
One thing I kind of respect about Taco Bell is that they don't pretend to really be authentically Mexican.
No.
You know,
it's actually not even ground beef. It's Chihuahua meat, I believe.
No quiero Taco Bell.
Wow, it's we might get a defamation suit for that one.
Yeah, it would take a lot of chihuahuas. They're not very meaty.
Yeah, but I mean, it's such a an Americanized fast food version of I guess real Mexican tacos.
Yeah, it's like Panda Express for Chinese food.
All right. Well, what's your favorite thing about Southern California? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook at Album Nerds.
Yeah, I went with a band we haven't talked about on the show in a long, long time.
Yeah.
And Don and I have never discussed. One of my favorites from the 90s, Stone Temple Pilots, formed in San Diego in 1989 as Mighty Joe Young originally, changed their name and became one of the most commercially successful rock acts of the 90s. Fronted by Scott Weiland with the DeLeo brothers, Dean on guitar, Robert on bass, and drummer Eric Kretz. We're going to be focusing on their debut album, Core, released in 1992. It achieved massive commercial success despite initial poor reviews and accusations of copying Pearl Jam and grunge, even though they were formed years before that stuff started breaking. Produced by Brendan O'Brien, who did work with Pearl Jam and a bunch of other acts during this time, reached number 3 on Billboard 200, went 8 times platinum, several hit singles, won an MTV VMA, and like I said, they were initially criticized for sounding like other alternative bands. Such an eye-rolly thing. Mm-hmm. It's just so rude. The album is now considered a seminal alternative rock release and remains their most successful album. It's probably their heaviest and darkest, blending 70s hard rock with alternative and metal, influenced by Pink Floyd, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Metallica, Led Zeppelin. I hear all those things. And why don't we jump in with the opening track, and pretty heavy opening track, Dead and Bloated. Kind of ominous, heavy, halftime track in D major, around 62 beats per minute. Kind of sludge metal undertones, certainly existential angst. Scott Weiland singing into the guitar pickup at the beginning of the album. That's where they get that, you know, kind of canned sound, distorted megaphone-like thing. I think he used megaphones in live performances to do those portions. Makes it eerie and intense. Dean's tone on the guitar is like a blend of clean and overdriven amps. But Scott's lyrics are stream of consciousness, aimed at creating mood and texture rather than conveying a concrete story, which for me at the time was kind of a break from all the overthinking with bands like Pearl Jam. It was more like Nirvana, where it's strokes of words that might take your mind in different directions.
Yeah, somehow, even though they're less grounded in reality or something, the lyrics, for somehow they're like more accessible.
Yeah.
You know, there seems like there's a backstory to every Eddie Vedder song. And these just, seem more transparent, even though they're, you know, less specific or something.
Kind of like poetry, you know, maybe more like The Doors in that way, where it's a series of images and lines. Some of them are kind of like dead and bloated, birthday, deathbed. But it explores themes of decay and existential dread and emotional stagnation. You know, I'm smelling like the rose that somebody gave me on my birthday deathbed. Like, that just sounds like he's having a bad day.
It's still very poetic.
Yes, it is. And I think that's what I appreciated about it. At this time, I was one of those open mic night poetry reading douchebags. Yeah. Well, I was a douchebag. I can't. The rest of them were talented poets, but I was a poser. But yeah, it's just so crunchy. And I remember arguing with people about this when they're like, "Oh, it's a Pearl Jam ripoff." And I was like, "This sounds. If it's anything, it sounds more like Metallica than Pearl Jam."
Yeah, there is a little melody thrown in there. You know, there's the whoa, yeah.
Yeah. But again, like, I feel I've come of age. When she peaks, I start to run. Like,
it's a really strong track.
Yeah. It was challenging to pick another song. There's so many that I love on this record. But and for the sake of talking about one of the biggest, probably their biggest songs on the album, let's listen to a little bit of Creep.
Bob has got a gun. Think you're kind.
I try to leave the word grunge out of this discussion, but the track is a slow-burning sort of ballad that is grungy, I guess, if there weren't so many other connotations that come with that term, in D minor.
The saddest of keys.
Very, very sad. So sad and angry at the same time. So Scott's vocals here, lots of rasp throughout this song and throughout the record.
Yeah.
On future records, he kind of ditched it, I think, because he was self-conscious about the comparisons to grunge and Eddie Vedder. Mm. I don't think they sounded vocally similar at all, but that's because I'm a fan. Mm. I'm not an outsider to it. So from the outside, I don't know. Maybe I would have had a problem with it. So apparently, Robert DeLeo drew inspiration from Neil Young's Heart of Gold while composing this one. But it's really Scott Weiland's reflection on personal struggles, self-doubt, apathy of youth, being caught between adolescence and adulthood. And I just think it's like feeling outside looking in. This was a very important song to me at the time. I loved it. I loved this album. What were your thoughts on this? Was this in your orbit?
Well, you couldn't avoid it back then if you were listening to, you know, kind of rock radio or alternative rock radio or watching MTV. But I remember, the first single was Sex Type Thing, you know, which was, you know, very aggressive and kind of metal-ish. And then I think the next singles were like Plush and Creep.
Yep.
And it really showed that they're a diverse band, you know, that they had a lot of tools in their wheelhouse. This kind of folky country sound, you know, was a pretty big contrast to, you know, the grit of, you know, Dead and Bloated and Sex Type Thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I admired that about the band. Yeah, so I think they can capture anger as well as they can sadness.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, just the line, like, I always thought about this a lot. I'm half the man I used to be. And I remember thinking, you're like in your 20s. What do you mean? And I think it probably means I make mistakes, maybe part of the rock and roll lifestyle or whatever. And sometimes I think back on this where I miss before the 20s, like those younger years where I was more pure in my approach to the world. Mm. A lot of men in their 20s, in the college years, late teens, early 20s, kind of do become creeps a little bit. So
speak for yourself.
I am, and I was.
But yeah, I mean, definitely a cynical, a vibe.
Yeah, the fact that I related to the song tells me a lot about where I was at that point in my life. All right, so why don't we go ahead and have you pick something, Don? You mentioned something a few times. Yeah. Feels like maybe you're ready.
Yeah, so as I said, the first song I ever heard from Stone Temple Pilots was Sex Type Thing. Let's hear it. That little riff there is kind of Metallica-ish. It's almost Enter Sandman.
It's more metal than grunge, in my opinion, at least this first record.
They do. I think they have a lot in common with Alice in Chains as well. But still, I think somehow maybe more accessible in some way. I don't know. It's dark, but it's not too dark or something. Or it's not scary, I think, in the way like Alice in Chains was to me. There's something sinister about Alice in Chains, and I didn't quite get that vibe from Stone Temple Pilots.
I think with Stone Temple Pilots, it was kind of more of a, like we talked about, a poetic sort of, take this as you will kind of a thing. And with Alice in Chains, there were specific references to addiction and real darkness in Lane Staley's life in particular. Sometimes, like, I'd be listening to Alice in Chains rocking along, I'd hear a lyric, I'm like, oh, ouch, that's horrible. So, yeah, that doesn't happen so much with this one. Although this song does have some dark subject matter.
Yeah, so it's this track is written by Dean DeLeo, Eric Kretz, and Scott Weiland, but it's from the first person perspective of an aggressor in like a sexual violence situation, which made it controversial because people end up thinking that since it's first person that they're that it's Stone Temple Pilots being the aggressor or glorifying this this way of
that seems kind of dumb that someone would actually, but parent groups and whatever, I could see getting. I mean, the first time I heard it, I knew it was like a commentary on toxic masculinity and being too, men being pushy sexually, no means no kind of.
Yeah.
One no isn't enough, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I mean, it should have been pretty clear to people because you even have like that typical victim blaming language, like the shouldn't have worn that dress. So I mean, it was pretty clearly a commentary on it, and apparently it was Scott Weiland was inspired by a woman he was dating who had been a victim of sexual assault.
Yeah, I think maybe because it was an aggressive rock song from dudes.
Yeah.
Snarly, I also read that Dean DeLeo was inspired by Led Zeppelin's In the Light on the guitar stuff here, but who knows? People say things in interviews. Yeah, this is a nasty little tune to sing along to if you start thinking about it. It's like, I maybe shouldn't.
Yeah. Don't do a karaoke. If you
like. Yeah. And if you do, don't make eye contact with anybody. You're going to jail.
It's probably.
So this album is loaded with good stuff. And there are moments on it where there's little instrumentals and some kind of departures from the formula of a hard rock band at the time, including this closing track, which has a unique sound, is over eight minutes in length, Where the River Goes. So this one was written by Scott Weiland and Dean DeLeo. I guess this was introduced early in Scott's time with the band. It explores more existential yearning and spiritual searching, but you know, some questions like, I want to know what the rent's like in heaven. I want to know where the river goes, probably like the river Styx, you know, like kind of like afterlife, like what happens after we die, a desire to transcend pain and discover, you know, meaning on your soul's journey, you know. But the soaring riffs, the kind of mirror Weiland's emotional tone, lots of instrumentation and atmospheric dynamics that kind of sound like the river's flow. Mm-hmm. But yeah, meaning of life, you know, where's the river go?
Yeah, I think it's a good ending for the album, mm-hmm. You know, to kind of end in a progressive way.
Yeah, this is, yeah, we got a little progginess here.
I think... I don't know, for some reason, if you're going to have a long track, it's, you know, kind of nice to, you know, to put it at the end of the album.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
But yeah, I think it, you know, you got all the hits sort of, you know, packed in the middle of the album and, you know, kind of challenge your audience a bit at the end. Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the STP catalog, but, I would have been interested in, you know, hearing them kind of do more progressive things like this.
Yeah, and their second and third, they certainly progress their sound, but probably more, at least on the second one, in a glam mm-hmm. rock way. And then on the third, a little bit of that flavor as well, but art rock
yeah.
stuff, a little more Bowie-ish, yeah.
Kind of psychedelia too.
Yeah. They start getting critical acclaim on albums after this one. So yeah, we've discussed, four solid tracks here on Core. I think it's time that we rewind and reflect on the album as a whole and figure out how we feel about it. All right, so overall, I like it.
I like it a lot.
I'll describe it briefly with my clickbait headline. Core, good God, y'all. What is it good for? An absolutely awesome 90s rock record. That's what.
Wow. Good one.
So obviously, I like this one. Listening to it this week over and over again was a pleasure. I had to get the CD out because it just sounds so much better than, I have it on vinyl too, but it sounds so much better than the compressed, you know, streaming service stuff. I love it. It's full of great songs and good vibes, even though it can be a little nasty. How you feel about this thing overall?
Well, I'll do my clickbait headline. Oh, when I feel Core still resonates today.
That's terrible. I mean, at least get the rhyme scheme right.
Yeah, I kind of phoned that one in. I just wanted to do a when I feel.
Okay. Or you could have just, and I feel it. You could have done that part.
Yes, that's true. I do feel this album. And I probably didn't back then because I was I was kind of a dick.
You weren't a dick. You were just
there was in other things
wrapped up in the Cure and all that
stuff. Yeah, we all had our teams, I think, that we were supporting. But yeah, I mean, definitely in hindsight, I mean, this is good stuff. It's, I guess what I like most about it, I think, is just the balance of aggression and like poetry and accessibility. Mm-hmm. You know, somehow it all just, it works. And it, you know, it's not a shocker that it was such a big hit because, I mean, I think it's so easy to be drawn into these songs.
It stands on its own. Mm-hmm. Forget about Seattle grunge. It didn't need it.
Right. And it's smart. You know, it's especially, you know, coming out of the metal era where, you know, it was all about, you know, chicks and partying. You know, there's a lot going on here.
And the band's great. The arrangements, the guitars, like it all sound, it's unique. It's inspired by classic rock, but completely their own. The tracks, obviously, you know, things like Plush, Sex Type Thing, Creep, Dead and Bloated, Wicked Garden, everybody knows those. But tracks like Cracker Man, love that. I don't know what it's about, but I love that song. The instrumental bridge, No Memory, is cool. It's a nice break.
I like it too.
Wet My Bed, that cool spoken word, weird poetry vibe. I liked it at the time just because it made it like a artsy record somehow to me. But yeah, like Piece of Pie, Sin, those are considered some of the weaker tracks, but I think they're awesome.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts? Any filler?
No, I You know, I like Wet My Bed, and I like, and I always like instrumental bridges in the middle of albums. So, and you know, I think Sin is a, you know, kind of a, I mean, outside of the hits, it's kind of like a cornerstone of the album. It's another sort of epic track, I think, a little longer.
Yeah.
But yeah, it, you know, lots of killers.
Production wise, Brendan O'Brien, I think, mixes it clean and pristine, but keeps it enough in the gutter that you can feel it. But every instrument's punchy. The band sounds huge for four guys, and the vocals are theatrical but human. So it's well presented here, I think.
I think he fought the urge to overdub the vocals a little much. So, yeah, I mean, well done. And then, I mean, replay value, yeah. It's a little long, I guess, but not compared to, you know, as we moved into the 90s, things got longer. This is in that 50-something minute range. So, yeah, lots of replay value. And it has, you know, it's got the hard and it's got the soft. It's, you know, it's got everything you want.
Like legacy-wise, as far as their second two albums, probably more of a reflection of them as a fully developed band after being through a big hit album and the pressures and coming out the other side. But it's kind of Southern California's loud answer to Seattle's brooding sadness. But they fused glam, grit, and alt-rock and made a uniquely Hollywood mutation of 90s hard rock alternative that stands the test of time, as far as I'm concerned.
That's a good point, you know, because they were, you know, even though they weren't from Seattle, they were lumped into that, you know, scene. And, you know, maybe the difference in the sound or something is that it's from LA. Maybe it just has a little more of the glam or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's just
a more of the rock.
Yeah. And maybe just a little sunshine, a little more sunshine to, you know, to make it more palatable.
Yeah. I'm glad we finally got to talk about this one.
Me too.
So Stone Temple Pilots' core reshaped 90s rock by fusing classic metal, grit, glam hooks, and alt-rock aggression into something all its own. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
I imagine we've both been rollerblading along, you know, with our Walkman, listening to these albums.
And I'm wearing nothing but a thong.
Yeah.
My rollerblades.
Well, while you were doing that, did you have an opportunity to dig anything from anywhere else?
Yes, indeed, I did. Brent Cobb, country artist that I love, go check out Shine On Rainy Day.
Any relation to Dave Cobb?
Indeed, they're cousins. So Brent Cobb and the Fixins, his band, put out sort of a southern rock album called Ain't Rocked in a While. July 11th, 2025, it came out, sort of a shift into that gritty Southern rock sound, recorded live with this touring band in studio. Standout tracks include Bad Feeling, Power Man, Take Your Meds, Until Dawn. Why don't we listen to a little bit of the title track, Ain't Rocked in a While. I've never heard him rock at all. So, you know, although some of the more recent albums have leaned a little more into this.
Unless rocking is the old euphemism for, you know, sexual intercourse.
Well, I don't even know where to go with that. Speaking of sexual intercourse.
Well, instead of having intercourse, you could have outer course.
Well, thanks for ruining it, Don.
You're welcome.
I can't listen to this anymore. All right. Additionally, I like to pick something from my vinyl collection I recently acquired, and this is thanks to our discussions maybe a month or two ago on our
the Butt Rock Battle
on our Record Rumbles series, where we did the Butt Rock Behemoths and Creed. Happened upon a copy of My Own Prison on vinyl, 2022 reissue. And I picked it up. Might as well get these guys in the collection. I think I might have the CD for Human Clay, but Florida formed post-grunge band Creed, founded in 93 by Scott Stapp, Mark Tremonti, Brian Marshall, and Scott Phillips, rose to fame on this record, which cost them $6,000 in recording fees that they scraped together song by song, hour by hour. Sold 6 million copies. Let's listen to a little bit of the title track, My Own Prison. I still regret not giving these guys more of a shot at the time. It's good stuff. I mean, it's fine. It's fun. and spiritual, and it's heartfelt. Yeah. It's real. It's not poser stuff. So
they're on tour right now, and people on my social media, like people whose opinions about music I respect, are just raving about how great these shows are. So
I think they turned it around. Yeah. I think they got through that tough period of the anti-Creed stuff, the butt rock stuff, and I think they've come out the other side. That's good. I'm glad they're having some success. Oh, that's really disgusting. The butt rock out of the other side. I saw your face, and I'm like, what did I say? How about you, Don? What you been digging on?
Well, David Byrne, perhaps you've heard of him, frontman of the Talking Heads. So David Byrne is back with his first new studio album since 2018's American Utopia. The album's called Who Is the Sky? It almost sounds like it's, is it a play? Like, who is the sky?
Who is this guy? Yeah. Excuse me while I kiss this guy.
It comes out September 5th. It's produced by Kid Harpoon, who I think is,
of course,
is a, I think he's an English songwriter and producer. He's worked with people like Harry Styles and Miley Cyrus. Okay. And he's working with a New York chamber ensemble called Ghost Train Orchestra.
Okay. He always keeps it interesting, right?
He certainly does. Yeah. Well, let's hear here's a song called Everybody Laughs.
What you gonna do? Everything is closer, everything
sounds
is
like it's from a Disney movie or Pixar thing, like Lion King 12.
Did you ever get a chance to listen to his last album, American Utopia?
I probably did once in 2018. Okay. I don't remember.
It was an interesting concept album, and I get the sense that this is gonna be the same sort of thing. Supposedly mini narratives based on I guess his personal experiences of life in New York City. So at the very least, it'll be interesting.
Cool.
And then another group I hadn't heard of before, Presto Ballet.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Have you heard of Metal Church?
Yes.
Apparently, it's the guitarist Kurt Vanderhoof. This is his progressive rock band. Metal Church is, I think, kind of a metal band. And so this is, I think, his progressive outlet. So in the spirit of, you know, progressive rock, this is a concept album. It's about a guy named Andy. He's a regular guy who's disillusioned with modern technology.
He left his awesome podcast behind.
I didn't make that connection. But yeah, he abandoned his phone, his computer, and his social media. And this is what happens when he disappears from society. But here's a song called Thinning the Veil.
I mean, just the album cover alone makes it clearly worth checking out.
Yeah. I think I skipped the title of the album. The album's called Dreamentia. Instead of Dementia, it's Dreamentia. Yeah. All right. Well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. And also, don't forget to dig on some other music podcasts like Pick a Disc. Matt Latham chats with guests about albums that mean something to them. In fact, I did it once. I did Depeche Mode Violator. But it's Pick a Disc everywhere you find podcasts.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Here we are again. It's that time on the show when I am reminded of the words of the Governator, Arnold Schwarzenegger. California, I'm not going to do it the whole thing, for me, is a place where anything is possible. I came here with absolutely nothing, and California gave me everything.
Well, he already had the body, so he had something, I think, when he showed up, right? Bodybuilding.
Yeah, he came over because of the bodybuilding, right. But he had no money, right. He had no place to live.
Just the pecs.
Et cetera. That's not enough for most people. My pecs didn't get me anywhere. All right, so normally we would spin the wheel, but we already know that we're traveling up north to Northern California next time. So yeah, that should be exciting and a whole different kind of vibe over on that section of the state.
Going up the Pacific Coast Highway, is that what it's called?
The PCU, I think the Californians call it, the hipsters. All right, so yeah, that should be cool. I'm looking forward to that. Then we'll be rolling to another state the episode after. We'll find out all about that next time.
Hey, well, what is your favorite record from California? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 299 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you once again for joining us here on the Album Nerds Podcast. We'll catch you next time for episode 300. Whew. In Northern California.
Better be a good one.
It's going to be great. I don't know why I did a Scottish accent there.
It's great. A great podcast. No, that was a good one.
Our podcast is a very, very, very fine podcast with deep dives and hot takes and dude's vinyl okay. on display.
The lyrics weren't as bad as ChatGPT usually does for you, so appreciate that.
I gave it better cues.
All right, we'll see you in Northern California.